The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Tony, you're welcome. Tony, we had a massive response last week to Martin Seligman, who, of course, the founding father, I suppose, of positive psychology, and a big beast in your world, I know. You worked with Martin Seligman, didn't you?
Well, he was my first PhD supervisor. I was working on hope, and I gave a lecture. I was over in University of Pennsylvania, and he came to me afterwards and said, look, do you have a supervisor? And he offered to be. So I was chuffed. And I went and sat with him by his pool with the two German shepherds that had featured in his learned helplessness experiments. And he's a pretty powerful mind. And, you know, I was in over my head. But, you know, we talked for several months about hope. And then he said to me, you know, I think what you're really talking about here is optimism. And I said, no, it's not the way I think about it, actually. He said, well, I think optimism is the way to go. And, you know, he kind of clearly decided on that. And I said, well, I want to hold on to my hope. So to hold on to hope, I had to let go optimism. So we kind of parted friendly. And the thing was that I believed that at the time I saw optimism as a kind of a passive thing. You know, you're waiting for something good to happen in the future. And I liked hope because I saw it as a more active thing. It's like you believe in the present that no matter how dark things look, there's something good in the present, something promising, and you engage with it in order to bring it out. And I was stuck on that, but we remained very good friends. And he is an absolute positive psychology has done an enormous amount, and we'll come to that. But you know, he's an extraordinarily bright man, and he was very good to me and very encouraging always.
And listen, I think, you see, I didn't really have a book to recommend to people because he had asked that I would read his actual autobiography, which I think it's a bit of a trek for people who are just looking for the principles of things. But you have a book to recommend that you think would kind of steer us in the right direction for a lot of the positive psychology
stuff. I think our own Professor Alan Carr in UCD, has written a really good book, probably the best around, on positive psychology. He published it last year. It's called Positive Psychology and You. And, you know, he makes a very strong point that this is not about feeling good and feeling great. And it's not about finding any kind of immunity from suffering. It's about how we grow in our ego strength, and how do we take care of ourselves, and how do we engage with life? Because that's what Freud found out. He found out that, just let me mention this, because I think positive psychology needs a context. So psychotherapy is, say, 120 years old, and it began with Freud, who was saying that, you know, there's something about people's early life that seems to remain with them. It has a huge impact on them. And he found a way to sort of lift up the lid and look at what we carry in our unconscious minds. And he made us aware of how extraordinarily vulnerable we are as children, how extraordinarily important it is to protect the childhood. He also, a lot of people have an impression of Freud, but one thing about him that I found remarkable and still find remarkable is that he questioned himself constantly. He was very honest about the limitations of his approach, and he was very reflective on what didn't work. So even at the age of 81 in 1937, sitting in his little garden studio in Hampstead in London, he wrote a paper, Analysis Terminable and Interminable. And in that paper, and I'm paraphrasing, but he says, you know, all my life I have been committed to uncovering hidden traumas in the mind, but I realize that's only part of how we heal. I always assumed that when early wounds were brought into the light of day, there would be a healthy ego that could step forward and take care of them. But what I've seen is that the healthy ego is more a fiction, an ideal fiction was his language, than a reality. So uncovering the wounds of the psyche is part of the process, but we need, and therapies since have focused on, how to invoke an adult in all of us. How do we strengthen the ego so that the adult can take care of what is broken and vulnerable in all of us?
Okay, I get you. So dragging it all up is only part one. I often feel when I look at Harry, Prince Harry, he seems like somebody who's had part one, but possibly not part two sometimes, doesn't he? That he is almost an open wound.
Well, yes. I mean, he does seem extraordinarily vulnerable. I really don't know what's happening for him. But we can hypothesize certain kind of losses in his life and certain kinds of traumas that he may still be trying to grapple with. And, you know, nobody wants to deny those because they're in all our lives for all of us at some level. And cognitive therapy, brief solution focused therapy, positive psychology, resilience training, all of these things are not a denial of those kind of vulnerabilities, but they're simply a way to take care of them. And Seligman sort of didn't really invent that movement. The movement was happening in the wake of Freud's admission. And I think it was gathering steam, and then he spearheaded it and amalgamated it into what is now known as positive psychology.
Okay, listen, that's not what our theme for today is, but that was nice to get that bit of overview and a bit of Freud. And God, Tony, you're a mine of information. So on what we were going to talk about today, which is, I suppose, something that's still very much with us, and it's something that actually kind of, the first hour panel there, it kind of percolated right through it, and that's living with uncertainty.
Yeah. Oh, boy. I mean, I think we're all still a bit shaken after yesterday. I was watching the match live and watched Christian Eriksen collapse and had, you know, and then subsequently was caught up in that very moving and extraordinary moving saga. It has a connection with today because, you know, we're talking about uncertainty and we're talking about COVID and we're talking about the future.
And so many people said, many people said about yesterday that it just put so many things in perspective in that very simple way of, God, you never know what's around the corner.
Exactly. And that's the thing about COVID. COVID hasn't made us more vulnerable. COVID has just made us aware of how vulnerable we are.
Yeah.
And issues like yesterday make us aware how vulnerable we are. We don't know what's going to happen. Now, we don't like that. We do not like that at all. It hurts. We're angry about that. And we try and invent certainty where certainty doesn't exist. But we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen in an hour's time. There's people making lunch and their dinner, and it may go swimmingly well and probably will. But, you know, it's possible that, you know, some people mightn't arrive for some reason, or some people might have some bad news, or that, you know, the carrots may be overcooked, or something can go wrong. And you know, when we get into a state of mind that nothing can go wrong, that I've sort of I've got my life together, I'm on top of things, and I'm now immune to that sort of tragedy or vulnerability, then we're fooling ourselves. And I think events like yesterday and COVID bring us back to an awareness that, gosh, we don't know what's going to happen. It's not easy.
But Tony, what you think we would have learned it at this stage, wouldn't you? Like, because clearly we can't have certainty, but we still do try to bring it on all the time, don't we?
We do, because our brains were not designed to think. This is a popular misconception. Well, at least they were not designed primarily for thinking, okay? Thinking logically, okay? Our brains were designed so that we could survive. And to survive, we need to predict. We need to know what's coming and we need to be prepared. So constantly, our mind is in a kind of an activity, it's preoccupied with making guesses about what's happening, what's going to come next. Whatever we're doing, we're all making guesses all the time. And sometimes they're well grounded in the past experience and in present circumstances, and they work out. But sometimes, you know, as the further we look into the future, the less we can be sure, and the more our guessing becomes unstable and uncertain and changing. And that creates anxiety. So anxiety, if you like, is It's just having too many unstable guesses going on in my head, you know, and the mind, because it's trying to protect us, will naturally look out for all the bad things that could happen, because that's what it wants to make sure we're prepared for. So the anxious person is in a state of constant instability in their mind. That becomes too much. And so some people then decide, well, I can't live with that, so I'm going to make up my mind exactly what will happen. And they become very rigid, and there are cults and all kinds of different things that know exactly what's going to happen. You do this, you're going to heaven. You don't do that, you're going to suffer. And life is boiled down to some very simple formulas. And then there's the person who feels depressed. And I feel for them, because somebody in depression, when it comes to predicting the future, they nail all their colours to a very negative mast, because they know that the future is going to be horrible because it always was. They know they're going to be horrible because they always were. They know that they can only see, and they only choose to see, very negative things, and they're completely convinced of this. And that gives them a kind of certainty in a way, but it's also a prison, a darkness that they get locked into.
But actually, people will almost crave that more than they would. A bad certainty is nearly better than a good uncertainty.
Experimentally, if I tell you, Brendan, I'm going to give you an electric shock now in the next 15 seconds. Oh, well, next 15 minutes. You will not like that, but you'll feel a lot better than if I tell you, now, Brendan, I might or might not be giving you an electric shock in the next 50 minutes. Because, you know, it is the uncertainty of it is we're in a state of high alertness and readiness and preparedness. We're on edge. Whereas if I know it's going to happen, I then think, okay, it's definitely going to happen. How can I begin to adapt to this situation?
Do you remember like how people used to clamour for the certainty of a lockdown, even though it was a very bad thing? A clamour build where people just wanted to just know, and okay, we'll just tell us and we'll suck it up, you know? So listen, let's get practical. So in terms of how can we learn to kind of live with and tolerate uncertainty?
Well, I think the first thing is as I say, just think about yesterday. And when we have those moments when we realize we realize what reality is, we accept reality, we look at it, and we bump up against it. I think we do a lot better when we accept that we are vulnerable, that we don't know what's going to happen, and that's the essence of life. Life is built that way, because that's what's most fascinating about all our lives, is that into the future, we don't know what happened, but anything can happen, and extraordinary things can happen, beautiful things can happen, as well as bad things. But it's actually what we're living, the life. So it's easier, I think, when we accept rather than when we fight it. When we fight it, we just double our trouble.
And is that the old chestnut as well, that like, I suppose the one thing we can exercise a modicum of control over is our reaction to things, so that if we accept things more, that then are we more immune to stuff happening because we're not reacting so much to it?
Yeah, I think it is.
Tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I'm trying to listen to what you're saying now carefully here, but I think it's if I run it by me again, Brendan.
The way people talk about that, if you have acceptance, that is the one thing you can control in yourself, is your reaction to things, and that if you accept things more, you're less reactive to them all. It actually means that regardless of what's going on around you, you are a little bit more resilient in it because you're not reacting all the time.
I think, yes. I think that all we can ever control is our reaction to things. We can't really control what happens when things happen, but we can't control how we react to them. And if we react to them by accepting them, something clicks into place. And when things click into place, human beings are remarkably resilient. They're remarkably able to cope with things. They don't know that until it happens. You look at yesterday, something awful happened, and then immediately something beautiful happened. Mm. There was a kindness, there was a caring, there was a solidarity. The best that what sport is all about, I think, really happened. So we don't know. But when you accept it, it can happen. I think as long as you oppose it, you're standing, you're hiding down in the back seat of the car rather than sitting in the driver's seat and saying, right, I'm going to face this.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're, are you, am I also hearing you say in there that, say if we're being anxious and we're catastrophizing about things and everything, that actually when they do happen, they're not going to be as bad as we imagine. We will pull strength from places.
I think that is, you know, it's the story of everybody who's been through shocks and losses in their life, that there's always something. They don't want to live that again, naturally, but they will tell you very often that some act of kindness came out of nowhere, or some opportunity, or some thoughtfulness, and transformed everything and became part of their path of recovery. And that's, I think, what we don't know. Now, it's not very big comfort. It's something you can only experience when you engage with what happens in your life. But I think one of the ways we can prepare ourselves is to look to what we have already survived and look to what we have in ourselves. And rather than be tuned in to a very frightening narrative about the future, why don't we tune in to what is within my control at the moment, what I can do. And that could be as simple as cleaning the kitchen or doing some gardening or going for a run or reading, you know, but just physically doing something. It brings me into a different relationship with myself and the world, because it's in the present, it's practical, I'm focused, and it ignites in my mind different kinds of streams of thought. I mean, it's not that the future hasn't become any more certain, but it's not where I'm living now. I'm also realizing, you know, I can do stuff, and if something happens, I'm going to do stuff. So there's
a positive feedback loop there, if you will.
Exactly.
But yeah, by going off and just doing something else, but something that's going to make you realize you're in charge. It's a bit like, going back to our friend Martin Seligman, it's a bit like that notion of starting from learned helplessness, but maybe coming to a point of learned control, would you call it, or just reminding ourselves that we have power in a situation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just to relate Freud's paper I mentioned with Seligman, both of them, Freud in that paper was saying that one of the reasons that people didn't benefit from analysis is that they seemed to kind of be frightened of recovery. They were so locked into what they knew that they were frightened of changing and taking a risk to do something different. In Seligman's work, you had the two dogs who'd been electrocuted who were in the den. We won't talk about ethics approval here now for that, but they even when the electricity was turned off, they were afraid to move out of that space because he described, he said, I had to drag them. I had to take the two dogs and drag them over the plintel or the threshold, and they would discover then that it was okay, they weren't going to get a shock. I think I've lost my train of thought, Brendan. Now,
it's that creating that feedback loop around learned control of a thing than learning helplessness.
Yeah. So if you think, so the first half of psychotherapy is all about trying to understand why we got into those places of feeling so powerless and so pained and shocked in our lives. And the second part, which is what I think positive psychology brings, is saying, okay, what are the skills that can help me to kind of move myself into a different experience of my life? It doesn't make me immune to pain and brokenness, but it does give me a different sense of myself. I can draw within myself on some agency, on some, you know, ability to calm and steady myself, on some skills to actually create a better mood state, such as gratitude and meaning and all those things he talked about last week. Yeah.
So act out of it, like act out of the situation you're in. And even, I think, move sometimes, change your position and stuff can actually move you out of a situation,
well,
can't it?
Can I just give two extraordinary examples?
Yeah.
You had both of them. And I said, look, you had Sinead on last week, you had Vincent McMorrow on yesterday. I mean, they, to me, epitomise what mental health is about and what a full and happy life is about. It's about, each of them were remarkable in how they described how vulnerable they were. And yet each of them also found within that vulnerability a kind of a strength to live. So Sinead talked about all the physical stuff, and she said, I'm not going to get this is just a fact of life. Now, so I can't sing, but I'm going to write. I'm going to do something creative. And James, you asked him, was he cured? And he said, well, no, I'm not really cured. He said, I took, you know, this issue of control that was a negative in my life and turned it into something beautiful and creative and extraordinary. Now, so I think when we accept vulnerability, engage with it, and find the strength and creativity to do something with it, then we are on the way to mental health and a full and happy life.
Okay. Can I ask you finally, just something that came out of what you've been saying there, is that are we all quite addicted to, you know, we talk about safe spaces these days, but are we all quite addicted to, like the certainty thing, that we'd prefer a bad certainty than a good uncertainty?
Yes, yes.
Are we a bit addicted to our safe places, even if they're not good for us? Yeah.
Well, the devil you know is better than the one you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, there is that. I think, again, it is... It's how most people who are hurting have been hurt not just once, but many times. It's what they know. It's what life seems to be for them. And they are reluctant to believe in anything else because they could be disappointed again and again. And so they hold on and they reduce their expectations because it's
safer.
Protective. Yeah. But I think it's what I was just listening to the great psychologist Bono and his language on this. It's so much more elegant than psychology.
The song he's done for the Euros.
I mean, a heart that hurts is a heart that works. From a broken place, that's where victory comes. I mean, what... That just about summarizes everything I've been trying to say. It's not that victory comes from doing five different things from a self-help psychology book or listening to so many TED Talks and then you're going to not be hurt. No, that's not it. It heart that hurts, it starts with hurt. And I was very moved by some comment last week after Seligman. Somebody asked, you know, this is very positive, but where is there space for suffering that happens in our lives? And I think that positive psychology is an unfortunate word. It can sometimes feel like, you know, if you just read the right books, watch the right TED Talks, you'll just step onto a wave of self-esteem and surf through the week and be fantastic. But it ain't like that. And you know, as I say, positive psychology, and then that everything else is negative, and it's obviously your fault. You haven't read the right books and you haven't watched the right TED Talk and you're just missing it all. It's not like that. There are different skills, but they complement. And I think it's this notion centrally that when we're hurting, we need someone to mind us. And when we step away and leave this therapist's office, we need to be able to invoke something in ourselves, which skills like how to calm myself, how to be grateful for what I have and what I worked out today, how to set goals that are realistic and achievable. All these basic, simple life skills are really important to learn because they're the ways we take care of ourselves.
Yeah, okay. Listen, never mind Bono, Tony. This is all in the old sayings, you know, people saying that Mick Quinn says his favourite expression is that knowing yes or no may not kill you, but the indecision might. Paddy in Galway, how do you make God laugh? Tell her your plans. Tomorrow is promised to no one, says something else. So look, it's there as most things are in the folk wisdom for us. But we'll get the message someday. Tony Bates, thank you.
And just to say that I did some notes,
yes,
especially on this, and you have them, and you the reference to Alan Carr's book, Positive Psychology in You. So they'll be up, or maybe they'll be available
on
for people.
We'll put them up now on rte.ie /Brendan. And Tony, you're so good to do those notes as well, because I know a lot of people have told me that they do go and get them afterwards and they'll maybe listen again on the podcast, and I think people get a lot out of it. So look, thank you as always, Dr. Tony Bates, and I'll talk to you soon, and we'll take a break.
Email Brendan@rte.ie.